I had so many questions. Is that the kind of thing a landlord can put on Craigslist? Is it in the lease? Is your landlady human?
She is, yeah,
Jake said.
There are some humans who know just enough about us to know they don't want to know more. Look, I have to work in the morning, so I'm going to sleep.
I didn't want him to go. I wanted him to stay up and answer all my questions about monster-human relations and property management. But he did look pretty tired, so I only said, "Good night. Thanks for letting me stay here." Jake disappeared into the bedroom and closed the door. I didn't feel right using his computer and poking around his house while he was in the other room, so I went out into the backyard. I kicked off my shoes and stepped onto the lawn. The grass was scratchy and dry. I lay down, hooked my hands behind my head, looked at the sky. Every time I thought I was getting a grasp on the rules of this new world I had awoken into, they shifted again. Violet and Mr. Willow insisted there was an obvious boundary between the worlds, a line with good humans on one side and evil creatures on the other. But even if I didn't trust Rain's motives or Ingrid's explanations, they certainly didn't rank above Willow and Brian Kerr on the potential evil scale. And assuming they weren't secretly planning to make a meal of me in the middle of the night, Zeke and Jake had been nothing but kind. I didn't know who to believe. They all wanted me to be afraid of something. Monsters, humans, magic. But all I wanted was for things to start making sense again. Maybe there was something wrong with the fear center of my brain. Maybe it had been damaged when I died. Maybe a worm got in there during all that time I was in the ground and chewed up one important knot of neurons, the knot responsible for warning the rest of me not to get into cars with murderers, or accept help from psychotic cult preachers, or go home with monsters who eat human corpses. In quiet moments, when I held my breath and listened, I imagined I could hear the worm still digging around, breaking connections any normal person's brain should be able to make. I had never known this world existed. I hadn't asked for any part of it. I didn't want it. But you can't go back to not knowing something once you've been thrown into the middle of it. The air was cool, crisp, and the night was peaceful. I watched the stars, and I thought about monsters and magic and murderers. And it wasn't like sleeping, but it was as close as I could get. Chapter 28. Before I discovered what I had become, before I learned how much time had passed while I floated in the stars, before I made a list of all the ways I had tried and failed to kill myself, before I had a body count and an endless supply of murderer's memories chasing around my head, I woke up in an unmarked grave, and I killed a man. And I went home, barefoot and chilly on the empty streets, spitting mud from my mouth and scrubbing dirt from my eyes. I went home. There's a story about Yuri Gagarin, the first human to travel into space, and what he said when he came back to Earth. April 12, 1961. The Vostok 1 capsule and its pilot were only gone for 108 minutes. But those 108 minutes took them into space for one complete orbit, the farthest from Earth anybody had ever ventured. When Gagarin landed, so the story goes, a farmer and her daughter saw him parachute to the ground in his orange flight suit and his helmet, and the woman asked him, "Have you come from outer space?" He wasn't wearing a space suit, although that would make the story better. The Soviets didn't put their cosmonauts into spacesuits until after 1971, when Soyuz 11 suffered catastrophic decompression before re-entry, and its three crewmen became the first and only humans in history, so far, to die in true space rather than on the launch pad or in the upper atmosphere. But before that, a man fell from the sky, and when the farmer asked if he came from outer space, he replied, "As a matter of fact, I have." He told her he must find a telephone to call Moscow and let them know he was home.
That's how the story goes. It's a foolish story. A silly story. But it's the kind of story we want to believe of humankind's first space explorer. That young man with the big, bright smile who might have been the boy next door if only he hadn't been the one to leave the Earth instead. I was thinking about Yuri Gagarin as I walked home and blood flowed through my brain again. Hi, Mom and Dad. Sorry I'm late. Have I been gone long? That's what I would say. I had no idea how long I had been lying in that grave. It felt like eternity. It felt like no time at all. They would ask me where I had been. They would say, "We thought you were dead." And I would reply, "As a matter of fact, I have been." Dogs snarled as I passed and threw themselves hysterically against their fences. Dead birds littered the ground in small, sad lumps. Twice I caught myself wiping invisible blood from my fingers and cringing at piercing screams I couldn't hear. I was confused and disoriented, but the neighborhood was familiar. I wasn't very far from home. Close enough that if I had asked to borrow the car, Dad would have told me to walk instead. Our house looked much the same, but there was a flower bed in the yard that hadn't been there before, and one of the sick old trees was gone. Dad had been talking about having somebody chop it down forever, but I never thought he would do it. There was a hole where the stump would have been. There were no lights on. I had lost my keys and my phone. I crossed the lawn, avoiding the scattered dead birds, and punched in the code to let myself in through the garage. Mom's car was there, but Dad's was gone. This is what I told myself when I went inside. It was the same night as the party. Somebody had played a prank on me. A joke. My family didn't know anything was wrong. In the morning, I would call my friends and they would laugh themselves sick. I would laugh too. My father would frown. Meadow would roll her eyes. Sunny would ask me if it was scary being buried, even as a joke. Mom would help me plot my revenge. I should go downstairs and shower and get to bed. Tomorrow I would laugh and everything would be fine. For a few minutes, I tried to believe. Then I saw the note on the counter. It was addressed to Greta, one of my mother's postdocs. Mom's handwriting on a plain white sheet. Greta kept an eye on our house when we went out of town. Brought in the mail. Watered the plants. I picked up the note. Read it twice. Set it down. On the calendar on the refrigerator, there was a red line drawn through a week at the beginning of June. In big, looping letters, Sunny had written, "To the lake!" My mother's aunt gave us a new calendar every year. It had been African mammals before. Now it was tropical birds. They had gone to the lake cottage without me. My hands began shaking and I couldn't control my breath. There was a police detective's business card clipped to a magnet next to the calendar. We weren't the kind of family that ever needed to call the police. Our house had never been broken into. Our cars never vandalized. Our safety never threatened. The card was half hidden behind a coupon for an oil change, like it had been there so long they had stopped looking at it every day. I checked the bedrooms to be sure. The house was empty. I went into the study and turned on my mother's computer. Mom had dozens of articles bookmarked, from the Evanston Roundtable, the Review, even the Tribune. They all told the same story. 17-year-old Breezy Lynn of Evanston had gone to a party with friends, but she never made it home. Police had found my phone and keys at Nate Havers's house. They had talked to my parents, Melanie, Maria, Tatiana, and all the people I knew at school, my friends at the skate park on Lakeshore Drive, teachers and guidance counselors, everyone. There had been community meetings, bake sales, organized searches. Nate's parents had given a statement. They had no idea there would be underage drinking at their son's party. They were helping in any way they could, etc., etc. I had been missing for a year. I kept reading. The articles helpfully informed me I was a good kid with good grades and no history of trouble. But I was also friends with a group of teenagers who had a tendency to get a little wild. My friends must have loved that. Pride more than indignation. That's how they would react, as long as nobody's college chances suffered. They would have relished telling the cops and counselors all about my mostly imaginary reputation. The police never admitted to having any leads. The most recent article was from several months ago. Either the news had stopped caring, or Mom had stopped collecting. I went into Mom's personal email. She never changed her password. And found the emails she exchanged with her sister Colleen. Mom explained they were leaving town for the week because Meadow had been having trouble in school, and Sunny was depressed, and they all needed to get away. Every day was difficult. Breezy was supposed to be graduating, getting ready for college, growing up. Mom didn't know how to have hope anymore. She wrote that she still froze every time the phone rang. She didn't know what my father was thinking. Aunt Colleen told her that she couldn't give up, that her daughters needed her now. "Breezy needs me," Mom had written. "She needs us." I could hear her voice as I read, resigned, torn with exhaustion. One of the news articles in the roundtable reported that Dr. Erin Donahue had cried openly at a meeting as she stood before the community and pleaded for information about her daughter's whereabouts. My mother never cried. Not in private. Not in public. Not even when her own mother had died at the end of a long, slow sickness. Mom got angry instead of sad. Her voice rose. Her skin turned pink. Her hand shook. And after the storm passed, she would laugh and say, "Well, I'm Irish. I'm allowed to have a temper." She didn't cry. I read the words, but they slipped over the surface of my mind, painless and slick. I felt sorry for her, this mother, this weeping, unfamiliar woman who was mourning a lost daughter who might have been anyone, a whole person made of more than blood and dirt and ice. I left the computer on and went through the house again. In my parents' room, I found a prescription for sleeping pills on my father's side of the bed and a book about grief on my mother's. Across the hall in Sunny's room, her soccer uniform was thrown over her chair, freshly washed but not folded. I was relieved to see she was still playing. Meadow's room had changed the most. She had replaced her black bedspread and black curtains with pale blues and greens. Her pictures of blood-red roses and tormented angels with simple line drawings of faraway monuments. The Colosseum. The Great Wall. The Sphinx. I went down to my own room last. I imagined myself opening the door and finding myself lying there in bed. A sleepy, confused version of me who would blink at the light, shove her messy hair out of her face and ask, "Who are you?" My school books were arranged in a neat stack on my desk, my laptop closed and unplugged beside them. The cops would have taken it, looked through my photos and emails, laughed about the tameness of the porn, saying, "Wow, that girl was either confused or greedy. But she could have gone for something a little more hardcore and made our jobs more interesting." There was a faint depression in the comforter where somebody had sat at the edge of the bed. I sat in that same spot and pressed my hands together between my knees. It was Mom who came down to my room, probably. But maybe Dad, too. Never together. Mom would come late at night, or early in the morning before anybody was awake, open the door quietly, shut it behind her. Meadow and Sunny would know she did it, but they would never say anything. Sitting there on my bed, I thought, I can lie. I can't remember, I could say. I don't remember anything after the party. I don't know what happened. I could lie to the police, to the doctors, to my parents. I could lie to my sisters. I don't remember leaving the party. I just woke up and came home. I didn't even know how much time had passed. And they would nod,
Their expressions would be sympathetic and relieved.
They would take me to the hospital.
A nurse would examine me. She would ask delicate questions and she wouldn't believe my answers.
The police would want to know about the dead man by my grave.
I don't know him, I would say.
I've never seen him before. I don't know anything about him. I didn't kill him. They would ask if I knew he was a murderer.
I would lie, lie, lie. I inhaled and exhaled, closed my mouth and stopped breathing.
I waited for the burn in my lungs, the pressure in my chest building into pain. But it never came. What came instead was the memory of blood on my hands, whimpering winter wind, a family dinner ended by bullets and knives.
I jumped up from my bed and stumbled into the bathroom. I retched until my throat was raw and my gut ached. I felt hollow, my insides scraped out. I rose to rinse my mouth, and that's when I saw the bruises around my neck. Handprints, a butterfly-matched set, livid and purple. I fit my own hands to the marks and tried to remember what it had felt like, being strangled. I didn't leave that night. I stayed in the silent, empty house for 5 days. During the day, I hid in my room behind the closed door. When Greta came over, I listened to the floorboards creaking, water running, doors opening and closing. At night, I went out again. I left my own skateboard leaning against the wall in the entryway and stole another from an open garage several streets away. I spent the night skating around, past familiar houses and streets, unnoticed. I didn't speak to anybody. I avoided all contact, all conversation. Some people made me nervous in a way I couldn't define, but I scurried away from them like a cockroach hiding when the kitchen light comes on. I didn't think to examine the sensation at first. The first time I truly paid attention to somebody who felt different was at a stoplight in Morton Grove. It was late at night. I stopped to wait for the light to change, green to yellow to red, and the white walk sign appeared. A single stopped car. The driver's face was a pale smudge through the glass, but his shadow was breathtaking. I first felt it from the sidewalk, but it was only a tickle, a spider creep brush on the back of my neck. 10 feet away and it unfurled like a black sail, a balloon of gauzy silk. I wobbled on my skateboard, put 1 foot down to catch myself, and stopped in front of the car. The headlights drowned me from the waist down. Through the windshield, the driver's face was unremarkable. Round and soft, a middle-aged man carrying his years in his jowls. Balding. Ordinary. I knew him. I didn't know his name, but I knew him. I had never met him before, but I knew him. Our lives had never intersected before that moment, but I knew without a doubt one true thing about him. He was a killer. He tapped the horn. The light was green and he was shaking his head at me, inching the car forward. Startled, I ran back to the sidewalk. The man drove away, and with him went his shadow. I stood on that corner for a long time as the lights cycled through their rhythm of stops and starts. Being so close to that man, meeting his eyes through the windshield, seeing the bland impatience there. It left me with a jittery feeling, a nauseous clamor of nerves I didn't understand. It wasn't until I was back in my basement with the blinds closed did I remember where I had felt it before. The man at my grave. The one I had killed with a touch. Before I even knew what I was doing. He had felt like that, in those first panicked moments after I woke up. I began looking for killers. Short of walking down the street and hoping a murderer was waiting in line at Starbucks, I wasn't entirely sure how to go about finding them. Not until I remembered Joya Allen. Joya Allen had been a casual friend of mine in middle school,
But for high school, she went to St. A's, and I didn't see her much anymore. During our junior year of high school, she killed her stepfather in a car accident. She hadn't been reckless or drunk. She'd lost control of her mother's BMW on the icy street and hit the man in their own driveway. The impact slammed him against the front of the house and broke his spine. It was officially an accident. But there were rumors. Joya had never liked her stepfather very much. He was overbearing, intrusive, handsy with her friends. They were only rumors. I didn't know the limits of my newfound sense. I didn't know if guilt mattered, if intent mattered, if accidental deaths were the same as cold-blooded murders. I didn't know anything. I certainly didn't know any convicted murderers. But I did know where Joya Allen lived. I went to her house one night and lurked like a stalker in the hedge separating her yard from her neighbors. I didn't know which bedroom was hers, but it didn't matter. That close to the house, close enough I could have tossed a handful of pebbles up to the second-story windows. I felt a dark mist of guilt flowing outward, as encompassing as fog from the lake, spreading from a single point in an upstairs bedroom. My fingers itched. I clenched my hands into fists at my sides. I pictured myself walking over to the door and finding a key under the mat, waiting until I was sure everybody was asleep, slipping inside, creeping up the stairs, soft steps on soft carpet, standing over Joya as she muttered in her sleep. She would be dreaming of the man she had killed, remembering how she felt in the moment she made the decision to hit the gas, anger and hatred and disgust and fear. The thump of car striking flesh, a crunch, remembering and reliving. I would place my hand on Joya's warm forehead. I would feel for the shadow of her guilt, and I would pull. I wondered if it would be easier to kill the second time. The possibility made me nervous in a way I didn't like. I didn't want to hurt Joya. I left her house without looking back. But I paid more attention after that. There were more killers around than I expected, but I kept my distance and kept my hands to myself. I always returned to my house before dawn. I drew the curtains and hid from the sun, a silent ghost in my own home. Silent, but not alone. The man I killed was my constant companion. A real estate agent found his body a few days after I woke up. I read about it in the news, but those bloodless articles felt distant and impersonal compared to what I had taken from him. His memories, snapped into my mind at the moment of his death, had faded from immediacy, but I still had them. I will always have them. When I lay in the dark and could not quiet my mind, he and I crept together through a small house in the drifting snow, peered through the windows, and thrilled when the woman walked into view. I didn't want to understand. I wanted him out of my head and his disgusting memories gone. When he intruded and I caught myself yearning, planning, wanting, I flung myself out of bed and ran into the bathroom. I searched through the drawers until I found a pair of scissors, a pack of disposable razors, a metal nail file. I hoped the pain might drive him away, but the sight of my own blood rising from the cuts on my legs only made the memory stronger. Children slumped over their dinners. The husband, the interloper, dead on the floor. And her, clutching at the stab wounds in her chest, dying. After the blood stopped flowing and the cuts began to heal, I took my father's sleeping pills from his bedroom and swallowed them all. It didn't work. Number one on my list of failures. I went to the lake and tried to drown. I stole rat poison from a neighbor's garage. Failure, failure. I made a list to keep track. I took a kitchen knife from the wooden block on the counter and filled the bathtub, climbed in and trembled, blade in hand, until the water was pink and cold and my skin was pruned. Failure. According to the calendar, my family was due back from the cottage on Sunday. I cleaned the shower and the bathroom, wiped everything dry, and put the towels in the washer. I erased all the evidence I had been there. I looked for cash in my room, in Meadows and Sunny's, but decided not to take it. I took only a pen and the Space Camp notebook from my desk. I balled up the dirty clothes I had been wearing when I died and stuffed them into a plastic bag. I didn't know what else to do with them. I left before dawn. I swung the plastic bag over my shoulder, dropped the stolen skateboard to the asphalt, and I left. Chapter 29. I was still on the lawn when Zeke came home. Watching the stars and tracking the satellites as they passed overhead, wondering which of them might be the ISS. Before, in my previous life, my normal life, I would have been imagining how I might describe that night later, in an interview, when somebody asked me, "When did you first know you wanted to go into space?" And I would say, "I always knew." And I would talk about lying on the grass and watching the space station in orbit. The truck pulled into the driveway. The front door opened and shut. I felt the grasping shadows that whispered, "Killer." A minute or two later, I heard voices through the open bedroom window. Jake was angry about Zeke's field trip to Wyoming, angry about rain, angry about the visit to Ingrid's, and probably angry about me, too. But he didn't really get around to that before a door slammed and the argument ended. The kitchen door squeaked open. "What are you doing out here?" "Trying not to eavesdrop." "Looking at the stars," I said. The southeastern sky was washed out by Denver's yellow glow, and the dark shoulders of the mountains loomed in the west. But there were still more stars than I ever saw at home. I rolled my head to the side to look at Zeke. "Are you in trouble for helping us?" Zeke let the door swing shut behind him and sat on the edge of the concrete patio.
"Jake's just being an asshole."
I thought maybe Jake had good reason to be upset, but I wasn't about to complain about being rescued from that red room.
"It's okay for him to do any stupid thing, but if I..."
Zeke stopped abruptly, kicked idly at the crisp grass.
"What are you even doing out here? It's the middle of the night."
"I don't sleep."
"Why not?"
"I mean, I can't sleep. I haven't slept since I woke up from being dead."
"Huh. Weird."
"That's one word for it. Can I ask you something?"
"I guess,"
Zeke said warily. "Can you die?"
Yeah. We die. Not as easily as humans."
"What does that mean? Extreme old age? Ghoul cancer?"
"No," he said. "Somebody pretty much always kills us."
The way he said it, so flat and accepting, it was worse than anger or fear would have been. "Habit," Jake had said, when he compulsively checked through the front window. "Who?" I asked. "People like that guy in Wyoming?"
"Yeah, humans," Zeke said, like it was obvious.
"Maybe it should have been. Is that what happened to your parents?" A pause, then,
"Yeah."
"I'm sorry."
"It was a few years ago."
I didn't think a few years would make any difference when it came to losing your parents. "How old were you?"
12. Jake was 17. 18. It happened right after his birthday.
"My sister Sunny is 12, I said, mostly to myself. 13 now. I missed her birthday.
"Is she your only sister?"
Zeke asked. "No. There are three of us. Meadow is in the middle."
"We..."
The word caught in my throat. For a second it hurt to speak. "It's just the two of them now. A few years ago, when I started high school, Mom and Dad had called a family meeting. They had never done that before. My sisters and I joined them in the dining room.
Mom and Dad assured us nothing bad had happened, but they wanted to talk to us about the plans they were making in case something ever did. Our mother's older sister, Kathleen, had agreed to take us in. Meadow and I exchanged a skeptical glance across the table. Kathleen's second husband hated kids in general, and us in particular. But that was what the adults had decided. Aunt Colleen was a photographer and always traveling, and Dad hadn't seen his family in China since he left for the United States at 18. Kathleen was the best option. Mom went over our college funds, their life insurance, their wills. Dad assured us they weren't sick or taking up skydiving. They just wanted to be prepared. We listened, but the words washed over us without impact, because whoever believes their parents are going to die? Even Sonny laughed when Dad said we would have to fight among ourselves over who got his best bathrobe, the soft gray one we all coveted on cold winter mornings. Meadow added that we would also fight over who got Grandma's china set because none of us wanted to be stuck with something so ugly. It was hideous, with big pink flowers and faded green leaves, smears of brown paint meant to be branches, and gold edging like fat worms. Mom shook her head and said she would ask the lawyer about arranging for the china to be mysteriously dropped off a moving truck during probate. None of their plans had required me to take care of my sisters on my own. To become responsible, to get a job, to pay the bills and solve the problems, to be the adult. It had never even come up. "Can I ask another question?" I said.
"Can I stop you?" Zeke replied.
"Unlikely. My third grade teacher, Mr. Schrader, told my parents I wasn't allowed to raise my hand in class anymore because I was bothering the other students."
"Were you?"
Mr. Schrader was a jerk.
He was the same teacher who had called me a liar in front of the class when I couldn't share any Chinese words as part of Culture Day because my dad had never taught me any. Ingrid said everybody knows stories about things, people, like me.
"Okay."
"I don't know those stories." I sat up, drew my knees to my chest, and hugged my arms around my legs. I tried looking it up, but they don't cover this stuff on Wikipedia. All Google gave me was a bunch of Dungeons and Dragons character profiles and this random French TV show. Nothing helpful.
"Humans don't know anything," Zeke said.
"Yeah, we suck." "I'm serious. Do you know something? Have you ever heard of anything like me?"
"There was this guy we used to know. This human. Jake and I sort of lived with him one winter."
Zeke leaned forward, rested his chin on his knees, mirroring my position. It made him look young and vulnerable.
"He was in Vietnam, you know, back in the 60s or whenever. I guess they attacked a village, killed everybody who lived there."
He sounded honestly baffled when he added,
"I don't understand human wars."
"Neither do we," I said.
"After they took out this village, people from their unit, what's it called?
Platoon."
"Right. From their platoon. They started to die. They would go off into the jungle and something would get them. They couldn't stop it. They only saw it once."
A faint shiver wormed down my spine. "It was one of the people from the village? Somebody they killed?"
"A kid, yeah. A little boy."
"But only the one kid," I said. "Millions of people died in Vietnam. Why did that one kid come back? Why was he special?" Zeke only shrugged. "Does anybody know?"
"I don't know. Magicians don't exactly share their secrets with people like us."
"Ingrid thinks I'm going to be like that kid. Start killing a whole bunch of people."
"Ingrid can't tell you what you're going to do. Magic can't do that."
"You just said you don't know how magic works."
"I know that much," he said.
It could have been reassuring, but I wasn't in the mood to be reassured. I especially wasn't in the mood to be reassured by the vague and ill-defined rules of what magic could and couldn't do. "One more question." If Zeke really wanted me to stop, he would have gone inside already. "Why did you help Rain when she asked?
I know you didn't want to, I said, before he could deny it. Whatever it was made your brother angry enough to threaten to cut me into little pieces if I was part of it.
Jake said that? Zeke said, surprised.
Well, no. He didn't say anything, but he was holding a scalpel when he didn't say it.
He wouldn't do that.
So what was it? I get the impression she's not a friend of yours, and to be honest, she creeps me out.
She's a nightmare, Zeke said.
I started to answer, hesitated, turned the word over in my mind. You don't mean a bad dream, or like a really unpleasant person.
No, I mean she's a nightmare.
I don't know what that means, I said.
I don't know how to explain it. That's what she is. She can do things to people's minds just by talking to them. Make them think they're in danger or lost or whatever. Give them real nightmares.
My skin crawled with an uncomfortable realization. Do they have to be asleep?
No. She can do waking nightmares, too.
Rain. In the red room, speaking in that sultry, low voice, and the images that rose unbidden in my mind. The screaming woman, a mother separated from her children, the blank-faced men dragging her away, telling Brian Kerr to come into the room, and how quickly I had wanted to agree. They had her mouth taped shut before I woke up. They knew what she could do. And again, at Ingrid's house, repeating what Ingrid was saying, and how clearly and how vividly I had seen what she wanted me to see. I hadn't questioned it at the time. I hadn't wondered where the thoughts were coming from, or why Ingrid wanted Rain there at all. I had been so focused on figuring out what I could do to other people, I hadn't suspected what she was doing to me. She can make you think anything? Anything at all? I said.
I don't think so, Zeke said. I think she can only use something you're already scared of. Like, if you've never been scared of spiders, she can't make you think giant spiders are going to eat you. But if you're scared of heights, she can make you think you're going to die falling off the bed.
What was I scared of? If they had asked, I wouldn't have had a good answer. But Rain didn't need to ask. She had plucked it from my mind and turned it back on me. She and Ingrid together. I took a breath, reflexive, unnecessary, to steady my voice. Okay, that makes every conversation I've had with her 100 times more disturbing. But it doesn't exactly answer my question. Are you avoiding answering? If you don't want to tell me why you helped her, it's fine. I'm just curious.
It's not that. It's just, we haven't been here very long. When we first got here, we didn't really know anybody. We didn't know who to trust. We met Ingrid and her son.
The pervert.
He and Rain have a thing.
I so don't want to know the details.
You really don't. Anyway, they helped us, I guess.
Zeke didn't sound like he had appreciated the help.
Found a place to live, told us who we could trust, who we couldn't, you know. It was, more than we expected.
Why?
Nobody likes ghouls.
Is that it? Rain and her creepy boyfriend helped you, and you owed her?
A little, yeah. A couple months later, she came by one day and said she was calling in a favor. Family emergency. It didn't sound like a big deal, so Jake went with her. They were gone all night, and when he came back, he had
a long pause.
Food,
Zeke said. It took me a second to understand he didn't mean takeout from the local Thai place. Rain's never killed anybody, I said. He said nothing. Neither has Jake. He definitely hasn't. Zeke was relieved, but he tried to hide it. It wasn't hard to guess what kind of secrets he had been imagining Jake was keeping from him. But if Rain can do what you say she can, she wouldn't have to do it herself, would she? I said. She could, you know, scare somebody else into doing it. On purpose or on accident.
I guess.
Does it work on you? What can she do? Zeke was quiet for a moment before answering.
We can tell when she's trying to do it.
That sounded like a qualified yes, but it also sounded like he didn't want to talk about it. I let it drop. I said, Oh, by the way, I met Steve.
I told you not to go into the basement.
When has that ever worked? I'm a girl in a horror movie. I have to go into the basement.
Is that what you think this is? Zeke asked.
I woke up buried in somebody's backyard. I'm dead, but I can't die. I'm a monster. What else am I supposed to think?
I don't know.
That's super helpful.
I don't know how else things can be.
Zeke's voice was quiet.
All at once, I wanted the conversation to be over.
I didn't understand why he was talking to me anyway. Maybe he was bored or lonely, but it didn't matter. It was just another day, another stupid monster for him. But I didn't want to hear that this was normal. This was ordinary. This was how people lived. People who had been there all along. Never mind that I had never been smart enough or sharp enough to see them. I wanted him to go away and leave me alone.
You don't have to stay up to entertain me, I said.
Zeke gave me a quick look.
Yeah, okay.
He stood up and offered a quiet good night as he went inside. I missed him as soon as he was gone. Alone was worse. I hadn't noticed when I had been running away across the country because I hadn't wanted to notice. But now that there were people who knew what I was and didn't seem to care, the thought of endless empty days and nights of solitude stretching into the future was too painful to consider. I was going to need a hobby. Learn to knit. Get a library card. Join a Warcraft guild. Take up vigilantism. There are so many more hours in a day when you don't spend a third of them sleeping. I was going to have to learn how to pass the time if I was going to stay like this forever. Chapter 30. In the morning, I was reading the news from Cheyenne when Jake shuffled into the living room. Zeke was asleep on the couch. He hadn't stirred when I came in as the sky started to turn pink. Jake picked up the blanket from the floor and dropped it over Zeke, tucked it over his shoulder.
You could have made him take the floor, he said.
He yawned and ran his hand through his hair. I shrugged. It's fine. Jake sat down and glanced at the computer.
What's that?
I turned it so he could see the article I was reading. They had found Brian Kerr. I explained. He's the one who takes the monsters, wherever they take them, to try to change them. I said, wherever, but I was thinking, whoever. There was the figure of a woman lurking at the edge of all my thoughts. The mother to whom Mr. Willow was bringing his tributes. Ingrid had said it might be a creature, a monster, but in my mind she was tall and grim and featureless, a terrible silent shape with arms opened in a gathering embrace. I hadn't told anybody what I knew about her yet. Not Rain, not Ingrid, and I wasn't going to tell Jake either. She was the linchpin at the center of Mr. Willow's world. I was keeping her to myself. I kept telling myself it was because I wanted more information. It felt so clean and rational to think of it that way. Information. Facts. Data. I couldn't trust secondary evidence. I had been telling myself that all night. A responsible researcher would go to the source. The article about Brian Kerr didn't have much information. The paramedics and state police had been called to the house after Kerr's wife found him unconscious on the premises. Nothing about the room full of belongings. Nothing about the blood. There was a picture of him perched on a wooden fence and smiling, majestic mountains in the background. He looked normal, non-threatening, but the sight of his face put a knot in my stomach. I scratched my fingernails softly against my jeans and imagined a phantom pain. the splinter-sharp agony of scrabbling helplessly along a long stone tunnel. There were too many of Brian Kerr's memories trapped in my head. So I turned the conversation to something that had bothered me since the night before, when I finally realized how Rain had been manipulating my thoughts in the Red Room. I asked, "Does Rain have kids?" Jake hesitated, which was all the answer I needed. "She does," I said. "Doesn't she?"
"Why do you want to know?"
"Zeke told me that you helped her with a family emergency. And she did her nightmare thing on you. Made you think something bad would happen if you told anybody. That was about her kids, wasn't it?"
"Is that true?"
Zeke pushed the blanket down and sat up. His voice was rough with sleep.
"Jake."
"That's not what happened,"
Jake said. "A boy and a girl, maybe 7 or 8 years old?" Jake shook his head.
"I have no idea how you know that. I know she didn't tell you. She doesn't want anybody to know."
Maybe not, but she had wanted to find out, without asking, if I had seen them. That's why she had made up that other woman and put her into my mind. It might have worked, too. I might have been overcome with sympathy, eager to share that I had seen the kids at the church. If only I hadn't been so wrapped in myself, so convinced that being this thing that I was, this inhuman monster, meant being so unique and isolated that the idea of mothers and children and families all in it together hadn't even occurred to me. She didn't tell me, but she does, right?
"Yeah. I don't know how old they are. They're not human. Rain's a lot older than she looks."
"What are you talking about?
Since when does Rain have kids?"
Zeke asked.
"It's not..."
"That's what that was about?"
Zeke said.
"When you went with her that day?"
"Yeah, but it's not..."
"You know what she is, and you still..."
"Zeke."
The angrier Zeke got, the more tired Jake looked.
"It didn't happen like that. The kids needed help."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
Zeke asked. Jake glanced at me before answering. I couldn't read that look at all, but I had a feeling they would be having a very different conversation if I wasn't in the room.
"They were staying with their grandfather, their human grandfather. He didn't know what they are."
"Why would she leave them with a human?"
Zeke asked, disgusted.
"I don't know. She didn't tell me, okay? All she said was that her kids had called her and she needed to go pick them up right away. By the time we got there..."
Jake rubbed his hand over his face.
"The kids were defending themselves."
"What did..."
"I'm not going to tell you what he did."
Jake's voice was sharp. Zeke shut his mouth.
"It doesn't matter. It was technically suicide, but it was messy enough that the cops would ask questions. So we cleaned it up and got them out of there. That's all. I don't know where she took them after that. She said she was going to find somebody else to look after them, but I don't know who."
Two little kids with the power to manipulate thoughts, separated from their mother, protecting themselves, and your friendly neighborhood ghoul on call to help clean up the crime scene. I was selfishly glad Jake didn't share any details, but I understood now why he had been so angry at Rain for getting Zeke to help her.
"You should have told me,"
Zeke said.
"I thought..."
Jake sighed.
"You're right. I should have."
"I need to talk to Rain," I said. "Can you call her?"
"Why?"
"Wherever she took them, it wasn't as safe as she thought. I think she went looking for Mr. Willow's people because they have her kids," I said. "She kind of told me when we were stuck in that room, but I didn't realize she was talking about herself."
"You know where they are?"
Jake asked. "I know where they were a few days ago." Zeke pulled the blanket up to his chin and slumped into the couch.
"She's at Ingrid's. I'm not calling."
Jake went to get his phone. I didn't tell them that it might be too late for Rain's children. I wasn't planning on telling her, either.
Not until she told me what I wanted to know first.
Chapter 31. Rain refused to come to Jake and Zeke's house. She listened to my proposed trade, information about her children for information about Willow, and accepted with a reasonable minimum of cursing and threats of bodily harm. "Meet me downtown," she said. "Pearl Street, in front of the bookstore. Be there in about an hour. There's someone you have to meet." "Who is it?" "The guy who put me in touch with our Wyoming friend," she said. "I told you about him, remember? He's one of the lucky survivors. Speaking of which, you see the Cheyenne News this morning? How does it feel to be famous?" I said, "I'll be there," and hung up. She hadn't said to come alone, and I didn't know how to find Pearl Street anyway. It only took a little bit of wheedling to convince Zeke to come with me. Jake left for work after making Zeke swear about a dozen times, a dozen different ways, not to do anything stupid and definitely not to go anywhere with Rain or any of her friends or any monster-hunting humans we might come across. Zeke rolled his eyes, but he promised. It was mid-morning on a warm, sunny Saturday, the sky cloudless and deep blue, and Pearl Street was crowded with people. Couples walking with cups of coffee in hand, kids playing, buskers plucking songs on their guitars. After the strangeness of the past several days, everything felt off, artificial, as though the entire city had been lowered around us like a movie set during the night. Rain was leaning against a storefront when we arrived, hands tucked into the pockets of her black hoodie. "You know Ritter?" she asked Zeke. "Climber guy, lives in his van, not too fond of showers." "Human?" "Yeah, but he's harmless. Totally chill. He works at a bagel shop." "That's a stellar character reference," I said. "Considering the people you've been hanging out with, you have no room to judge. How'd you like their ugly little roommate?" "Oh, Steve, we're cool. We understand each other." If I was expecting Rain to be different, some external evidence of fear or relief, a glimmer of maternal instinct, or even guilt for putting her children in danger again, I was disappointed. She looked and acted exactly as she had the day before. We might have been making plans to go see a movie rather than discussing the fate of her missing children. Rain's friend was sitting on a low wall in front of a bookstore and cafe. He lifted a hand in greeting when he spotted her. Started to smile. Grimaced instead.
"What did you bring him for?"
he said. Zeke stared right back and didn't say anything. Rain leaned over to kiss the man's cheek. "Not my idea. Don't worry, I won't let him bite. Ritter, this is Breezy. Breezy, Ritter. She's the one I told you about."
"You're the one that put Brian Kerr in the hospital,"
Ritter said. He was closer to 30 than 20, with dirty blonde hair pulled back in a limp ponytail and a scraggly beard coaxed into twin loose twists. He was wearing ratty jeans and flip-flops and a red t-shirt that said, "I Ski Heartland," in block letters. He held a ukulele in his hands, and the case was open on the ground in front of him. A few dollar bills and change scattered over the velvet lining. He had never killed anybody. "I guess so," I said warily. "How did you hear about that already?"
"News travels,"
Ritter said.
"I'm not the only one around here who's had a problem with those assholes. Trust me, I'm not going to judge you for it. That man has done some serious shit. If you messed him up, I want to buy you a drink."
He squinted in the sun.
"Or I would, if you weren't like 12.
My age is kind of a divide-by-zero number at this point. How do you know them? Ritter gave me a wry smile.
"I used to be one of them."
He didn't say "one of them" like he was talking about a group of kids he used to know. Like he would say he used to be in a band or on a team. Or even the shame-faced way he might say,
"I used to be a young Republican."
He said it like it was something he had lost. Something mournful from long ago.
You mean you were... I didn't know how to ask. Different?
They don't go after normal kids, Ritter said. I used to be able to see ghosts.
Are you sure they were ghosts?
Zeke asked. Ritter twitched his shoulders.
Yeah, I'm sure. I used to call them my glowy people. My stepmom thought I was making things up to screw with her.
When did you start seeing them?
Zeke said.
I don't remember,
Ritter said, frowning.
I could always see them. I was never scared of them or anything. They don't do anything, right? They just float around. There was one on the street outside our house. I was like 8 before I realized nobody else could see it.
But you could always see them, Zeke said, even when you were a baby.
What does it matter? Rain asked. Ritter brushed his fingers over the strings of the ukulele. He was looking more uncomfortable with every question.
I think so. I don't exactly remember, you know. Why?
Something happened when you were born, Zeke said.
Ritter's fingers fell still on the instrument.
How do you know that? Your mother died.
Jesus, could you be more tactless? Rain kicked at Zeke's feet. He stepped out of reach.
Nah, he's right, Ritter said. It's fine. How did you know?
Humans can't see ghosts without a reason. That takes magic, and magic means somebody died.
Ritter snapped his fingers and pointed at Zeke.
See, that's what I didn't know before. I know it now, sure, but they never told me that. Pastor Willow and all his people. He never told me there was an explanation. He never told us shit.
How did you meet them? I asked.
I got in trouble when I was a kid. Got caught, you know?
Ritter held his fingers to his lips to mime smoking a joint.
My dad and stepmom decided I should start going to this youth group thing at this church our neighbors went to. This place over on Baseline. I don't know if it's still there. This was, I don't know, 10 years ago. I thought it would be talking about Jesus and playing basketball and going camping and whatever. And if I got my grades up, they'd forget about it and stop making me go. It was mostly fine, too. A little woo-woo and everything. No prayers or shit. I doubt any of them ever even read the Bible. They had this house where we could hang out without any adults. That made it fun. But there was this one guy, this older kid. He was really intense about it.
Ritter plucked at the ukulele strings again, a quick progression. The notes vibrated brightly and faded.
Intense about everything. Like he didn't want any of us having fun.
Brian Kerr, I said. Ritter nodded.
It was only the second or third time I went when he told me he knew I was different. I didn't plan to tell anybody. I was a dumb shit. But I wasn't stupid enough to announce to a bunch of Jesus freaks I saw dead people. But they were saying, like, everybody experiences things they can't explain. The world's full of mysteries. Maybe you know about them. Blah, blah, blah. And I thought, maybe they'd understand. And one day Brian came up to me and said, we can make it go away. I told him I didn't know what the hell if he was talking about. So he got one of the younger girls to talk to me. She was always saying things like, it doesn't mean you're a bad person. It just means you have something bad attached to you. You have a darkness inside you. Other crap like that.
Violet's lines hadn't changed much since then. Ritter went on.
I didn't listen at first because, whatever, my ghost didn't hurt anybody. But she was really convincing. I started to think, oh shit, she's right. This isn't normal. There is something seriously wrong with me. So I said, okay. They could fix me.
What did they do? I asked.
They took it away,
Ritter said. How? Ritter looked at me for a long, long moment.
I don't remember.
In Brian Kerr's memories, there were towering pine trees, the scent of the forest, a yawning dark hole in the side of a mountain, and fear. His fear. He had been dragging other people to their deaths, but he was as scared of what waited in that darkness as they were. No matter how many times he walked away alive, he was still afraid. "But it worked," I said. "Whatever they did, it worked." Ritter glanced down, tapped the wooden body of the ukulele, shrugged and laughed a little, humorless and tired.
"Yeah, I guess. I miss them, you know. The ghosts. They never hurt me. I kind of liked them. That one outside our house, I couldn't tell who it was, but I used to pretend it was a kid like me who died riding his bike or something, and I'd talk to him like he could hear. I wouldn't mind seeing them again."
He was quiet after that. All around us was the lazy commotion of a crowded street on a Saturday morning, but nobody gave us a second look. I felt the tendril tug of a killer, somebody besides Zeke, but I couldn't pick out who it was before the sensation was gone. "That girl you met," I said, "that was Violet?"
"Yeah, redhead. Sweet little kid, but creepy too."
"I need to talk to her."
"No way,"
Ritter said, shaking his head.
"Bad idea. All that stuff about being cursed and releasing your soul from evil and all that bullshit, she believes it. She believes everything that bastard tells her."
Maybe she had 10 years ago, but I wasn't sure it was true anymore. Violet had let me go, or tried to. Even Lyle, who I could barely think about without shuddering, had apologized as he snapped my bones and tore my skin. Something was broken at the center of Mr. Willow's congregation. His foot soldiers were not as loyal as he believed them to be. "I want to talk to her anyway. You know how to get in touch with them, don't you? Who did you call for rain?"
"This kid Danny. Danny Mendoza. He's all right. They told him they couldn't help him, but they kept him around anyway. Working for them, you know. Doing whatever."
Truck stop Danny. The trying-too-hard goth who could see a girl across a parking lot and know she was a monster and send her right into Mr. Willow's hands. No wonder they kept him around. Zeke asked, "Why would he do that?" Ritter shrugged.
"He's not into their shit, man. But it's not like he has anywhere else to go."
"You have to call him again," I said. Ritter was already shaking his head.
"Nope, not a chance. I am done with those people."
"You did it before."
"Because I thought..."
He stopped, looked at Rain, frowned in confusion.
"You said you needed... What did you need?"
"It doesn't matter," Rain said. "You don't care. You didn't care before, and you don't care now. You know it's none of your business." Ritter was holding the neck of the ukulele so tight I thought it would snap.
"It's only a favor," Rain said.
All of her easy friendliness was gone. She was looking right at Ritter, and her eyes were like embers. "A little favor. I'll owe you one. No big deal. Just call the guy." Zeke glanced at me, but I didn't need the warning. I knew what she was doing.
"I don't think..."
Ritter began, but he was reaching into his pocket for his phone.
"What am I supposed to say to him?"
Rain looked at me, and I said quietly, "Violet's the one I need to talk to."
"Find out how Breezy can talk to that Violet girl. That's all."
Ritter looked at the phone like he wasn't sure what to do with it.
"That's all? I don't want to go back. I can't."
"You don't have to go back. They'll never know you were involved." His face was pale except for 2 flushed smudges on his cheeks. He made the call. Rain leaned close to listen to the conversation, and she murmured in Ritter's ear to guide his replies. It might have been intimate, almost romantic.